Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
So I'm on Bear Creek Road. It's a really windy road that, you know, feels like it would be a death trap or like a slip and slide in the rain. I'm going to Big Basin. It's a state park. It's one of, I believe it's one of, if not the oldest state park in California. It's home to a lot of old growth ancient redwoods.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Our contributor, Anna Weiner, lives in California, where she writes mostly about the tech industry. And she called us recently on her way up to Big Basin Redwoods State Park, where some redwood trees are so old that they predate the fall of Rome. Here at the end of what's been an unbelievably difficult year in so many ways, Anna went to look at the damage from last summer's wildfires. Those fires were some of the most destructive on record, and Big Basin was squarely in their path.
I haven't been to Big Basin in maybe a year or two, and I certainly haven't been since the fires this summer. The park has been closed, and I don't know how long it will remain closed. I think that they're expecting about 10% of these trees to die. I just turned around the bend, and it took my breath away. There are three cars, one of which is totally flipped over, and they're all burnt out. Just like husks of three sedans, I guess. Maybe one was an SUV. And I'm going to keep driving now that I've seen that. But it's really, I think it's shocking in part because... Oh, did I lose you?
California, Oregon, and Washington all burned last summer, and the devastated areas together were larger than the state of Massachusetts.
The CZU Lightning Complex was one of the largest fires in California history, and it basically tore through Big Basin in a day. The fire started in late August, and Big Basin actually was burning for about a month, or the fires overall were burning for about a month. I'm in the picnic area of Big Basin. I'm here today with Ranger Phil Bergman, who has very generously offered to give me a tour of Big Basin, at least the parts that are still safe to walk through. What are all these nails on the ground from?
Well, they all came from, there were benches and picnic tables here.
So oh,
these
God.
Are picnic tables. And you can see the bolts that were holding the picnic table together. And if we look inside a couple of spots here, there were, like right here, see all these lag bolts going through?
There's some, you know, it's sort of funny to see what has been, what survives a fire. There's a little green water fountain that looks pretty much like it probably always has. In the debris around the store, there were some white coffee cups that seemed, you know, broken but identifiable. I hate this.
I've had a couple of months to let it soak in, but it was hard. First few times I came up here, it was still burning when I was up here, and it was like the upside down.
Yeah.
If you watch Stranger Things, it was just like, what is this place?
Yeah, this is like we're walking into the. There's this little redwood trail right at the entrance to the park. So I think I first visited Big Basin, I think the first year that I lived here, I went with my partner. And there's a reason why everyone always uses the word majestic to describe redwoods. They're unbelievably mysterious and domineering in a way, and there's this feeling that I often have when I'm at a place like Big Basin and around redwoods in California, which is just that time kind of stops and it's incredibly peaceful. it feels like a privilege to be around them, because, you know, in part because only 5% of the country's redwoods are still standing because of really aggressive logging. So, you know, it's like this intense somatic experience where, you know, your heart rate drops and the air feels almost intoxicatingly clear. So visiting Big Basin now is a really different experience. One of the most striking differences to me is that when you look up, there really isn't much of a canopy anymore. And these are trees that are famously green year-round. And to look up and see sky is sort of shocking. I mean, the trees are obviously still here, and the trunks are still here, and the trunks are largely black. It's really unusual to see this color palette, to see the leaves a kind of sienna orange, to see them burnt. Now we are sort of climbing through debris. It's just, oh, what appears to have been a squirrel.
So this is the bug. I was right there.
I'm beneath a tree that was at one point maybe 200 to 250 feet tall. And during the fires, it chimneyed, which is when fire gets in somewhere usually, or I think in this case...
fire gets in through some sort of breach, most likely at ground level, and then it just burns its way right up through the tree, just like smoke going out of a chimney.
Often this can result in the trees just popping their tops off. But what's interesting is that at the top there is some new growth or recent growth. There's still some green coming out of it. Yeah.
Yeah, we're actually on a road. The trail went down that way, I think. So.
Oh, we got a little bit off the trail.
Yeah, again, my landmarks are all gone.
Yeah. I think this year provoked a lot of conversations among people who live in the Bay Area and who live in California more generally about whether, how long they can stay, whether this is a sustainable place to live, and seeing, you know, the effects and the ravages of climate change come to people's front doors. I have sort of made my peace with California being a volatile place to live. I think a lot of people have made their peace with that. But something about seeing these ancient trees, some of the oldest living things in the world, and something about seeing them damaged by the sort of effects of climate change or the consequences of climate change. Yeah, it's really quite something to take stock of this. It's hard for me to absorb that it won't return to the way it looked probably ever in my lifetime.
Not exactly the same, but it'll return. Even 5 years from now, it's going to be green again, and it's going to be lush again. It's just not going to be as the same.
Yeah. I sort of love this one with the mushroom-looking base. A blooming mushroom spores or something.
What it is it's dormant cells. Hardly scientific, but they're sort of called into action when there's a disaster. If there's a fire or if the tree tips over, they kind of come to life.
Oh,
and
whoa.
Then they start to shoot out.
That's very reassuring.
Yeah, that's part of the process of redwood.
Anna Wiener reports for The New Yorker, and we also heard from Ranger Phil Bergman at Big Basin Redwoods State Park. The last 12 months have been, and it's a cliche by now, but by no means an overstatement, unimaginable. The wildfires throughout the West, hundreds of thousands of people marching for racial justice, the impeachment trial of the president at the beginning of the year, and toward the end a campaign to overturn the election that might even be called a failed coup d'etat. But above all, for just about every person on the planet, there was the fear and devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic. In the spring, when the first terrible wave of the pandemic made New York its epicenter, we started publishing dispatches from Dhruv Kular. He's a doctor at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in Manhattan. And every day, Dhruv went into the heart of things, the COVID ward. Here's Dhruv Kular remembering those first days in March.
I wake up before the sun is out. So I put my scrubs on and I call an Uber. And it's the first time I see plastic barriers between the passenger and the driver. We're both wearing masks. We cruise up Manhattan's east side on the FDR. I look out the window. I see the sun starting to rise over the East River. We get near the hospital. There's a few people scattered here and there, but mostly the streets are empty. All the stores are closed. Many of them have signs taped to the window saying that they are not open for business for the foreseeable future due to the pandemic. I've never seen Manhattan look like that before. I get in the elevator and go up to the medical floors. Outside, you can still hear the endless flow of sirens, new patients that are arriving. Many of them are struggling to breathe. Most need to be admitted. Some need to be intubated immediately, if not after a few days. Before I go into a patient's room, I make sure that I have my N95 respirator on. I have a surgical mask on top of that, gown, gloves, shoe covers, and I have a face shield. My clinical service fills with essential workers, bus drivers, police officers, delivery guys. Many of them don't speak English as their first language, and so on some days I organize my rounds by the language that patients speak. I take the interpreter from one room to the next and then switch to a new language. The other day, I went to see a man who spoke only Spanish. He was wearing an oxygen mask to breathe. Each day that I saw him, his breathing got worse, more rapid, more labored. His oxygen level was steadily declining. So I took a phone interpreter into the room with me. I said, "Your oxygen levels are now at a dangerously low level. We're getting to the point where we don't have a lot of more options. The next step would be intubation, a tube down your throat connected to the ventilator." I spoke in short paragraphs so the interpreter could convey the message over the hiss of oxygen in his room.
Su nivel de oxígeno está peligrosamente bajo. Estamos llegando al punto donde no tenemos...
About 30 seconds later, slowly, my message starts to register. His shoulders tensed up. I saw tears in his eyes. I told him, "I hope it's temporary. I hope it's short. But right now, it's impossible to say." He started to cry. With most diseases, we have a playbook. We know how it starts, how it evolves, and how it can end. With coronavirus, there are so many unknowns. Doctors gather around offices. We're on Zoom calls. We're reading Twitter, trying to figure out what the virus does to the lungs and other organs of the body. The uncertainty is both exciting and scary. We as doctors and scientists get to figure out a new disease and potentially how to conquer it. At the same time, you never quite know whether you're doing the right thing or not. At any moment, you feel like you might make a mistake that could hurt someone. When I walk out of the hospital, the sun is starting to set. I hear the cheers of people from across the city who have come to their windows, come out to their balconies. They're banging cowbells. I hear New Yorkers cheering for healthcare workers. I hear them cheering for us. I get home and I log on to my computer. It's time for a weekly Zoom call with my friends from medical school who are scattered across the country. One of them is sitting on a couch. He's still in his scrubs. He's eating a sandwich that doesn't look very appetizing. Another has a gray hoodie on. He's wearing his Harry Potter glasses, and he could really use a haircut. We talk about how there's a strange way in which the pandemic has made medicine what we always wanted it to be. We're exhausted, but we're content. All the frustrations of billing and documentation and prior authorization and electronic medical records, for the moment, they're all gone. When we're in the hospital, the mission is so clear. We're doing everything we can to save everyone who we can. I hang up the Zoom call. I open up a Word document and stare at the blank screen. I start writing. It's a chance to at least start to process everything that's happening. I know that tomorrow I'll wake up and have to do it all over again.
Dhruv Kular is a physician at Weill Cornell Medical Center and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. And you can read everything he's written from the front lines of the pandemic at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're spending part of this hour saying farewell and good riddance to 2020. Many of us have spent this year at home to a degree we never would have thought imaginable. Safe, relatively speaking, but struggling to fill the days and nights and not go nuts. And for a lot of us, I'm not going to shame anybody here, that's meant hours upon hours of video games. On March 20th, the very day of New York's lockdown order, Nintendo released a game called Animal Crossing: New Horizons. Here's Simon Parkin, who writes about gaming and technology for The New Yorker.
So Animal Crossing: New Horizons came out pretty much just as the world was going into lockdown. It's sort of like a digital doll's house, I suppose, but not as tragic as that sounds, maybe, for a 40-year-old man to be playing. Basically, you move on to an island, which is sort of barren, a bit of a wasteland. You essentially, you know, forage, collect wood, rocks, things like that, and slowly build up your island house by house. And there's an added incentive as well to do this, because you can invite friends from around the world onto your island and then give them a tour. And obviously, like, you know, when you get to your house, you want them to come in and for all to be lovely. And also for it, you know, I guess if we're honest, to be slightly better than their islands that they've been working on. And so for a few sweet weeks, it just was the thing that obsessed everyone on the internet. Just everyone, you know, we were all sort of showing off photographs or stills of our island, how it was coming along. And yeah, it was just a lovely moment, I suppose, when it was difficult to get outside. It was a game that allowed us to sort of frolic around in the countryside and sniff flowers without that being controversial. Okay, this is my island. It is called Willtown. Okay, let me take you up here. So this is over here on the left. We've got a large area of ground fenced in. This is my wife's industrialized rose growing outfit. You buy seeds for different varieties of flowers, and then by sowing those seeds, you can in time germinate a new color. And that's something that she spent a lot of time on. I assure you, this was like a popular thing. It's not just us. the game was invented by a Nintendo employee called Katsuya Eguchi, who found that he was just spending all his time at the office and not getting to see his children as much as he wanted. So he sort of made this game as a way for them to work on a project together, and in that way they were able to connect. And you know, I think that's been true for the Parkin household as well. It was nice to be playing a game all together, sort of as a family that we were all involved in and all contributing to. That felt good. And certainly Animal Crossing has enough scope to accommodate all kinds of different interests and different player types. And for me, the thing that, and it drives my family nuts, is I've got whatever the gene is that turns people into collectors and completionists. And so I just spend a lot of my time fishing at different times of the day, trying to find that elusive fish that, that you know, is going to fill that space. And, you know, I know for my daughter, she plays it in quite a different way. So she is definitely more into the social aspect of interacting with the different animals on the island. And she spent a lot of time trying to convince the animals she didn't like to move out. And the way you do this is just by sort of being mean to them. You shun them. And so sometimes I'd be playing the game and it would look like I was running to go and have a conversation with one of the animals. And she would just scream at me, "Don't, no, whatever you do, do not talk to the hippo because I want him out." She just wanted to nurture the perfect village and have it just so. And that's really what the game encourages. Well, she's got her house. We should go and see that. This is her house. She's got a beach house, which she picked out. And if you come down here just to the sort of sandy area in front of her front door, she's arranged like a load of different teddy bears and pandas having a picnic. It looks like they're eating sushi, which seems unlikely, but I mean, this is a game all about dioramas, and this is the diorama that she's chosen to make there. And I think, you know, I may have thrown in a teddy bear there to help her out. I wonder whether it was so special this year, just the timing with the lockdown, that I wonder if it will ever be the same again for, you know, for that generation who has now played Animal Crossing when the whole world, it felt like, was playing Animal Crossing. You know, there will be Animal Crossings again in the future. I don't know if it'll ever be quite like it was this year. Okay, let's come over to the... Oh, hang on, we've got to go up here, sorry. We've got to cross over. And here's just we've got an outdoor sleeping bag, a little campfire, and a telescope on the rocks on the northeasternmost point of the island. I don't know, just a little idea that there's, I guess, to extend the universe, there's more out there.
Simon Parkin. You can find his writing on technology at newyorker.com. That's from the record called Hark, a Christmas-themed record by Andrew Bird. Bird is a singer, a songwriter, a violinist, a guitarist, and he whistles quite a lot, certainly more than anybody in indie music. One of his most avid fans is The New Yorker's Atul Gawande. Atul's a terrific writer and a surgeon, and recently appointed to the Biden administration's COVID-19 task force. Atul is also a big music guy, and sometimes he has Andrew Bird on his playlist while he's in the operating room. Atul Gawande sat down with Andrew Bird at the New Yorker Festival in 2016.
I've been a fan of yours from the first album, 2003, Weather Systems. When I heard the next album, or two albums after that, Dark Matter, you said that, you know, when I was a little boy, I threw away my action toys and devoted myself to playing Operation.
Yeah.
When I was just a little boy, I threw away all of my action toys while I became obsessed with Operation.
Did you really actually want to be a surgeon? Because I've been hoping.
No, I was more interested in psychiatry, actually. I wanted to be a psychiatrist. Seriously, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Where did you grow up and how, and did you know you were interested in music? Were you actually, or were you thinking you might like to be a doctor?
Well, I grew up around Chicago, north of Chicago, in Lake Bluff, Illinois. And I started playing violin when I was 4, and it was just, it was something, it was my mom's idea, and I played Suzuki violin completely by ear for the first 10 years. And it was just something I did every week, almost every day of my life from before I was really a conscious human. So I didn't really think of it in terms of, and I still don't, as like a profession. So when I thought of like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? I thought, I like the interior design of the psychiatrist's office. I like the wood paneling and all the accessories. And I was curious about human behavior, but yeah.
You were growing up with lots of different interests as a kid.
Yeah.
What was the path that led you down this particular path, and what were the others that might have happened?
I didn't get really serious about music until I was maybe 15, when not much in your life is going very well, you know? And I was already pretty good at this, and I was looking for something, some sort of thing to feel good about. And I was like, wow, I already kind of have this in the bag, almost in half in the bag. And I threw myself into it in a sort of high school sort of, I'm going to be an artist sort of thing. And then my head was filled with all these lofty ideas. I'm going to be the greatest violinist. And it was my goth music, you know, in high school. I mean, all my friends were kind of the goth kids, but I didn't actually care for that music very much. I preferred, you know, Dvorak and Mozart's Requiem and all that stuff. It's the same thing.
You were truly goth.
I was old school goth, yeah. Yeah. But then I started practicing, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day. I got pretty fanatical about it.
You did classical music. By the time you went to college, it was with a focus on classical music.
Yeah, violin performance, yeah.
And where were you in school?
At Northwestern.
And so what were you thinking would happen after that?
Well, at first I was thinking, I guess I'm going to do this classical thing. Although I was starting to get hints that maybe that was going to be tough and I wasn't really cut out for it. I didn't love being in orchestras and I didn't get along with my teachers so well. They were trying to show me how to do one thing and I was excited about, you know, Hungarian gypsy music. Or I was like, look, I want to improvise my own cadenza in this concerto, and they say, no, you have to play the transcription of the guy in 1880 who did this, you know. And I was like, I want to bring improvisation back to classical music, and they're like, no, just do the program, and then when you get out you can do what you want. Which by the time I got out, I was so eager to do what I wanted that I haven't read a lick of music since I left school.
When did you start to think, you know, maybe this violin and whistling would be the basis for fantastic rock and roll?
Well, I kind of backed into it. I didn't whistle at first because I thought, oh, that'd be too cute, you know. But I whistle, if you hung out with me for a day, it would drive you crazy because I whistle nonstop. I often say if I'm not eating or talking or sleeping, I'm whistling, no matter what mood I'm in. And so I didn't think to put that on a record until Swimming Hour. And then it's when I started playing solo and I noticed, and I did started doing the looping, that the timbre of the whistle really cuts through all the mid-rangey violin stuff. It was more like a mix thing. I'm just trying to use everything at my disposal to keep people's attention in a solo context. And the whistling, I would fill my lungs with air and just hold a note until people stopped their conversations. And it was really effective. You know.
Because they wondered what the hell you were doing.
And there's like, what is that? What's that piercing sound?
There's something maybe where I resonate so much with what you do, and to some extent The New Yorker does, because it's occupying the space between being challenging and wanting to be generally connecting with lots of people.
Right.
And yet being relatively demanding, 10,000 word stories on why we itch and a woman who, you know, scratched her way all the way through her skull.
Okay. And is that your article?
I was me.
Okay.
That was one of mine. But the kind of thing that
I read.
I'm not toying with you.
Right.
But wanting to draw people in, but without the same tricks, right? That's what I think The New Yorker is generally trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's my approach to communication has generally been, yeah, a little bit perceived as maybe opaque or like or obtuse or whatever. But it's there for
cryptic,
you. If it's like there for you, if you want to dig into it, it's like, usually I start with a really strong melody and I'm compelled to sing that melody and I have a need for words. And I think, well, let's talk about something interesting. That's generally how I come at it.
This album is really different because, it's so direct and personal. You're singing about meeting your wife, and you're singing about having a child. Love to play a few minutes from Puma. The first time I heard this song, I felt like I knew exactly what it was about, and I hadn't read anything about it, heard anything about it. If we could play Puma.
Do you see particles in the air? Nobody notices, nobody cares. Oh, don't try to tell her she's less feline than human. Cause it gets lost to the rumor she's a girl and not a puma. And that light that shines is not a pearl, it's just a tumor. And she was radioactive.
Just a tumor, and she was radioactive for 7 days. And as soon as I heard that line, I'm a endocrine surgeon. I do thyroid cancer care. And I'm like, this is a song about thyroid cancer. And the treatment you undergo for it involves being radioactive for 7 days. And the doctor tells you to stay away. Only you made it this beautiful thing of because of the flying neutrinos and the gamma rays. But you wanted to hold her anyway. And you made this thing that's like a regular part of my life and what I do for people and turned it into art in a way that I didn't really even understand could be possible. It was this amazing thing. I mean, I play this song for patients now and I play it in my operating room doing these operations.
Yeah.
And being that direct is not something that you have wanted to do before, and I was really struck by your letting it hang out there and be that personal. I don't think you're entirely comfortable being there, are you?
No, I had some major, I paused for sure when I was working on this song, but I mean, how could I go ahead and make another record and have gone through what we went through without and completely omit these things that were so real and pervasive and just visceral? So basically that song opens with, do you see particles in the air? And this is when we were living in New York, in an apartment where you couldn't see much more than just a patch of sky out the window. And there's maybe an electrical wire. And have you ever had that experience where you look out at the air and you feel like you can see the subatomic particles? And it's probably just some dust, but either way.
In New York, yes.
Yes. And I was thinking, I mean, basically the song is about how my wife, Kathy, handled this really scary thing right after we had a kid. This really crazy, reckless thing, it seemed like. A guy in a spacesuit comes in and puts a pill on your tongue, and they say, okay, just take a cab home, but sit as far away from the driver as possible. And then she had to lock herself in her apartment for at least 7 days. And I took our son upstate just to assure that we wouldn't, be tempted. And I thought, this is crazy reckless, And I was thinking about those particles and how, wow, are we constantly being lacerated by these subatomic particles? What is cancer? I mean, that's my question for you. I guess what I'm wondering is like, and maybe there's been discussions of this or not, but does cancer have a purpose? There seems to be some genetic, it seems to be in our genetic code to some degree, and then there's environmental. But is there some reason cancer exists?
If I told you, then the song wouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
It occurs because we're constantly bombarded by radiation from the sun and from outer space, and our DNA undergo mutations all the time. We generate a cancer cell almost every day, and your body clears it out. And we have a defense mechanism that is really good at clearing it out. And yet, every once in a while, one can get through. And the longer you live, the more likely it gets through. And the shocking thing is it can nonetheless get through when you're a child. It can get through in young age, like you guys, and go onward. And the fantastic news is she's doing great. But but nonetheless, it is one of the few ways in which we're aware of our fragility, unlike a century ago, when you could get a flu, you could get a broken leg, you could get a strep throat. George Washington died from a strep throat. 3 days later, he was dead because we didn't have treatment for it.
Right.
And so I think it's still our being in touch with the fact that we're still animal, mortal beings.
I like to write about things that I don't understand, And it's, so let's not get to the bottom of it tonight. Let's not.
Exactly. But I don't have anything to write about.
The other part of that song is the reason why it's so upbeat is because it's more, there's other lines there that are about how my wife dealt with this scary thing with a sense of humor and grace, that impressed the crud out of me. But it was just, the line of we were on our way to get some test results and we knew something wasn't right. And she said, I'm afraid they're going to tell me I'm a girl and not a puma, which is an inside joke to some degree, but I just thought it was amazing that she was able to think that way, and it's such a scary moment. Like, anyway, she has kind of a very feline fixation and embodies that as well. So anyway.
I think this album though has done so well because it is accessible at times, and then other times when I didn't understand what Puma was about. I knew there was something personal in it, but it brought out something that was just at another level of connection, and that's what makes it art and what makes it beautiful with the music interplay, interplaying with the lyrics, And I think there are those many moments, you know, valleys of the young, which struck me as on one level being straightforwardly about having a child and suddenly not being connected to those people who have brunches and sleep in late every day. And yet there seems to be a whole nother layer to it that I never could guess or understand. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I mean, and I say that for the last verse, which gets kind of brutal. Talking about, it's based on an actual, something that a friend of mine went through, but it imagines two parents that are going to the aid of their adult child who's just tried to commit suicide, but they're at the end of their life or quite a bit, you know, they're still in that parent mode of like going to the aid of their child, who's in middle age, you know? So it's, that was kind of a sucker punch in the song, because I'm talking otherwise about these more superficial things that happen in urban environments between people who have kids and don't, and that chasm between, which is something to talk about. But this last verse was like, I'm going to grab you by the collar. Make sure you're really listening, you know?
Well, I want to thank Andrew Bird for the time we've had to mine a little bit of your life and music. You're an amazing person and musician, and we're in for a treat with you playing solo on stage and constructing your music in front of us. So I'd like to have a warm round of applause for Andrew Bird.
See the light, how it rains so hard on your heart. Planes, see you take such pains that she won't notice you. Vacant stairs won't make it you, no. You need a witness just to know you're there. From the tips of your fingers have a strand of hair. To know someone's watching you, watching me, watching you, and all that we look upon. You may not know me, but you feel my stare. And if she sees you, it changes you, rearranges your molecules. If you see how it changes her, she's a danger now after school. And if she sees you, it changes you, rearranges your molecules.
Andrew Bird performing at the New Yorker Festival in 2016. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
He's a gentleman of her eyes. Maybe she's a gentleman in disguise.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, to close the show today, our last show of 2020, I've invited Kevin Young to join us. Kevin is about to start a new job as director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. But thankfully, he'll continue on as the poetry editor of The New Yorker. And so I've asked Kevin to pick a poem to end the year. And given everything that's happened this year, it wasn't really possible to pick just one.
As the poetry editor, I've really come to see the ways that poetry can speak to the moment. People are writing about the pandemic quite directly. They're writing about the pandemic of racism quite directly. I think that witnessing is really important, and it's become all the more important this year. And a poem like Terrence Hayes's George Floyd acts as a kind of monument to him and a monument to a moment. And I think poems often are that. This is George Floyd by Terrence Hayes.
George Floyd. You can be a bother who dyes his hair, Dennis Rodman, blue in the face of the man, kneeling in blue in the face, the music of his wrist watch your mouth is little more than a door being knocked. Out of the ring of fire, around the afternoon came evening's bell of the ball and chain around the neck of the unarmed brother ground down to gunpowder. Dirt can be inhaled like a puff, the magic bullet point of transformation both kills and fires the life of the party like it's 1999 bottles of beer on the Wall Street. People who sleep in the streets do not sleep without counting yourself lucky rabbit's foot of the mountain lion. Do not sleep without making your bed of the river boat gambling. There will be no stormy weather on the water. Bored to death, any means of killing time is on your side of the bed of the truck transporting Emmett Till the break of day. Emmett Till the river runs, dry your face, the music of the spheres. Emmett Till the end of time.
This year has reminded us in many different ways of our humanity, of our frailty, but also our connectedness and the ways that we are connected in ways we don't even know. And poetry is a big part of that. The End of Poetry by Ada Limón, which was published at the end of April, helped us feel connected because it captured feelings we were all experiencing. I mean, frustration, exasperation, desire, distance. And Ada has this wonderful turn at the end that returns us to the body and the physical connection, the thing we were missing all spring. And I'm getting chills just thinking about it. I think The End of Poetry, through the power of poetry, shows a kind of almost protest against what poetry can do and what poetry can't do. And it turns out it can do a lot. Here's Ada Limón reading The End of Poetry.
Enough of osseous and chickadee and sunflower and snowshoes, maple and seeds, samara and shoot. Enough chiaroscuro, enough of thus and prophecy and the stoic farmer and faith and our father and tis of thee. Enough of bosom and bud, skin and God not forgetting, and star bodies and frozen birds, enough of the will to go on and not go on, or how a certain light does a certain thing. Enough of the kneeling and the rising and the looking inward and the looking up. Enough of the gun, the drama, and the acquaintance's suicide, the long-lost letter on the dresser. Enough of the longing and the ego and the obliteration of ego. Enough of the mother and the child and the father and the child. And enough of the pointing to the world, weary and desperate. Enough of the brutal and the border. Enough of, can you see me? Can you hear me? Enough, I am human. Enough, I am alone and I am desperate. Enough of the animal saving me. Enough of the high water, enough sorrow, enough of the air and its ease. I'm asking you to touch me.
Ada Limón, reading The End of Poetry. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour today. Thank you as ever for listening. Have a wonderful Christmas. Wherever you are, I hope you're safe, warm, and well. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
With additional help from Kyle Lawrence.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.